Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In this episode, Cancer Network's Tim Cortese spoke with Dr. George Nieva from Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California about the FDA approval of taletrectinib for patients with locally advanced or metastatic ROS1-positive non-small cell lung cancer. Topics of conversation included the agent's efficacy in patients with brain metastases, strategies for mitigating common toxicities, and the next steps for improving the use of immunotherapy in the field.
Is this approval for taletrectinib in ROS1 metastatic NSCLC, who does this most impact?
Well, this is an approval for a drug for anybody with advanced ROS1 positive non-small cell lung cancer. The approval includes patients who are both treatment naive, as well as those who've received prior tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
All right. Thank you. And what unmet need does this approval most address in ROS1 positive metastatic care?
It's a question of whether it's a new drug for an unmet need or a drug that really just has a lot of advantages over the currently available agents. In ROS1 positive lung cancer, we have choices now for our patients. In addition to crizotinib, entrectinib, and repotrectinib, taletrectinib is the fourth drug coming to market in that space. And it has a number of advantages over the other agents, has a very different toxicity profile with less central nervous system toxicity, and really excellent results from the standpoint of response and progression-free survival. The ROS1 inhibitors all, to some degree, inhibit ROS. The real question that drives their efficacy and toxicity is what impact they have on other tyrosine kinases and similar molecules. So taletrectinib is somewhat unique in that it's a little bit cleaner in terms of its targets. It has perhaps a little bit less in the way of activity against TRK and a little bit more specificity against ROS1. That's really the thing that I think sets it apart from a mechanistic standpoint from some of the other ROS1 agents that are out there. The results are that you see a little bit less in the way of central nervous system toxicity, which is really characteristic of TRK inhibition.
Great. Thank you. So can you elaborate on some of the more specific efficacy outcomes, the differences we saw between the TKI naive and the TKI pretreated patients in these trials?
In all things in oncology, the outcomes are always best when drugs are used in first line compared with second line. So when looking at the results of the TRUST-1 and TRUST-2 studies on which taletrectinib is based, we see that newly diagnosed patients have a higher response rate, 89% compared with 56%. And we see a duration of response that's significantly longer, 44 months compared with 17 months, and a progression-free survival, which is also much longer, 46 versus 10 months.
Great, thank you. So the trial didn't mandate baseline images of brain metastasis to follow the incidence of CNS progression throughout the trial. Can you just speak on that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Some patients with ROS1 disease will certainly have a central nervous system disease. The drug has a very high intracranial response rate in patients in whom there was known to have intracranial disease. Intracranial response rates in the TKI naive cohort were about 77% on average. Not having baseline imaging for the entire population means that there'll be a certain number of patients who are on the trial where central nervous system disease was unknown at the start of therapy. And this can have a variety of different impacts on the statistics of the trial. And these sorts of nuances are the things that make cross-trial comparisons of data sometimes very difficult. If you look, for example, at other studies with drugs like repotrectinib, you'll see very high intracranial response rates with that agent, upwards of 90%. If there's inconsistent treatment in terms of baseline imaging, this will of course affect those percentages.
Thank you. That you kind of went into my next question there about discussing the intracranial activity of taletrectinib. So is there anything else you could say about that, maybe about how it had improved efficacy in patients with brain metastases?
Sure. We see very high intracranial response rates with taletrectinib and repotrectinib and entrectinib. And these are all much higher than the drug that sort of started it all, crizotinib. I don't think there's many people in the United States that are still using crizotinib as first-line therapy for ROS1 disease, with the newer generation agents really, I think, commanding the majority of market share for what most practitioners are doing these days. But the good news for patients is that all the newer generation agents all have very good CNS penetration, and we can expect that patients who have central nervous system disease will have reductions in their tumor size in the vast majority of cases. And I think this means that there'll be fewer patients who need to receive central nervous system radiation, which is, of course, something that many people want to try to avoid.
Great, thank you. In your practice, how do you see you integrating taletrectinib? How do you see it integrating into your practice?
Well, this is going to be the go-to first-line drug in my practice. I had the opportunity to participate in the clinical trials with this agent. And I think for all oncologists, the more you use a drug, the more you're comfortable with managing its toxicity, the more comfort you have with understanding what's to come for our patient population and counseling them on what they can expect. So for me, it's a drug that I'm very comfortable with and is a drug I'll likely use primarily in the first line setting. I think for people who were treated with other agents, if they had received entrectinib in the past or some other agent in the past, then they'll certainly have the opportunity to use this drug in the second line. But the good news for patients are that we now have choices, and we have very good drugs for ROS1 disease between taletrectinib, repotrectinib, and entrectinib. And I think even crizotinib is a good drug in many parts of the world where they may not have access to some of the newer agents. I'm very happy that we have choices for patients. I'm very happy that we have such a wide variety of drugs. But of course, we still need to do better, and we need to find better ways of using these agents because they're still not cures for the vast majority of patients. While these drugs can be very helpful at debulking the tumors, we still need to do a lot more work on making this a disease of the past for those patients who have it.
I know it came up a little bit earlier. Can you speak about maybe how your patients experience the adverse effects they might see with this agent?
The vast majority of toxicities for this drug really center around the gastrointestinal tract. Nausea and diarrhea are really the mainstays of therapy. The good news is we're oncologists, and we're actually pretty good at treating nausea and diarrhea. We've done it for a long time. I think the 5-HT agonists are really very good choices for the nausea. 5-HT antagonists tend to be constipating. So the combination of both of those features really seems to help this patient population. And of course, we also have drugs that work on gastrointestinal opiate receptors like loperamide, and those work really quite well for the diarrhea. From the standpoint of toxicity management, we have a lot of good drugs available for that.
Awesome. That's always great to hear. So, looking into the future, what are the next steps that you kind of see or you anticipate looking towards the future of non-small cell lung cancer care?
We've arrived, I think, now at a very good place from the standpoint of understanding the different biomarkers of lung cancer. And I think the age of treating lung cancer like it's all one disease is now quite over. So we now have these biomarker-driven subtypes, such as ROS1-mediated disease, and we have the ability now to treat it very effectively for long periods of time with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I think the role of consolidation therapy for patients who have good responses is also very important because I think that extends the duration of time that the patients will stay on active therapy. And we need to find ways to really achieve disease eradication. Unfortunately, for many of the lung cancers that are not tobacco related, such as ROS1, ALK, many of the EGFR cases, there hasn't really been good immunotherapy that's been able to eradicate the disease. And many of these patients are going to be entirely unresponsive to PD-L1 blockade. So we need to figure out a way to fix that and make that happen. And I know that there's a lot of companies out there doing a lot of work on the best ways to make that happen, and whether it's with bispecific antibodies that target a second receptor, or some other strategy that really amps up the ability of the immune system to target these cold, immunologically unresponsive tumors, is where the future is going to have to be for us. The immunotherapy revolution in oncology has really been a wonderful thing. And the wonderful thing about it is that stage four patients are now curable where they hadn't been curable before. But I think for the primary TKI treated cancers, that promised land really hasn't arrived yet. And so we still have to figure out a way to make the miracle of immunotherapy work for these patients as well. And so learning how to do that, learning what levers we need to pull on lymphocyte biology to make that possible is yet to be seen.
Thank you so much for that really in-depth answer on the future of the non-small cell lung cancer care. That was actually really informative. Are there any specific agents maybe you're looking forward to seeing?
Bispecific antibodies that harness the immune response are going to be very exciting. I know that there are companies now that are bringing forth bispecific T cell engagers. In small cell lung cancer, we've really seen fantastic gains with that category of molecules, and I'm hopeful that a similar gain can be achieved in other subsets of non-small cell lung cancer. There are folks working on bispecifics of PD-L1 and VEGF. I think recently the excitement around that maybe has diminished slightly, but I think there are some other possible second targets that can be added. Interleukin-2 targeting together with PD-L1 targeting is one development that may be very exciting. There's just a whole host of approaches that people are taking. And the great news is that we have people taking dozens and hundreds of shots on goal as to what's going to be the best way to turn these cold tumors hot. And when that happens, I think we'll really start to see a lot of excitement. In the meantime, we're going to have to focus on inhibiting the targets, reducing cell division, using consolidation radiation, consolidation surgery, perhaps combining these drugs with chemotherapy. We've had very nice results combining tyrosine kinase inhibitors and chemotherapy in EGFR positive disease. Not a cure, but certainly something that extends progression-free survival. And we may need to apply that paradigm to ROS1, ALK, and some of the other diseases that can be modified with tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
Great. Thank you so much. Always love a good sports reference with shots on goal. That's about it for all my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I don't have anything else, Tim. I want to appreciate you and the opportunity to participate in this interview, and be happy to talk again if ever you want to chat.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.